Welcome to this Season 13, Episode 23 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday the 26th of August, and we're going to be bringing you some community news and headlines from the tech world. And joining me this week are Mark.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good. It's cooled down a bit. I'm much more comfortable than I was last time.
Yes, it's definitely more agreeable, I think. And Alan, welcome. How are you?
I too am not hot.
You can say that again.
So, other than us not being hot, Mark, what have you been up to recently?
I bought myself a pair of wireless headphones and I am absolutely a convert.
Wireless in the terms of the Bluetooth or some other wireless protocol?
Wireless in, well, they connect to my phone via Bluetooth, but they also do not have a wire going in between my two ears.
Oh, they're two independent little buds, are they?
Yes. So I listen to stuff in bed quite a lot. And I've had a pair of wireless headphones, like Bluetooth headphones before, but they've had a wire between them. So if I'm laying on one side, I have one in the side that's upwards and then the other one sort of dangling about in the bed somewhere and gets laid on and broken. And also with those ones, I found it a bit of a pain because like if the battery runs out, then that's it. You can't listen to them because you have to have them plugged in to charge. And then when they were charged, they wouldn't connect to the phone because they were charging. Whereas with these, because they're independent, they have separate batteries in. If you just want one of them in at a time, the other one can be charging.
Oh.
They have a little case that you pop them in and they magnets into the case with a nice clunk and they charge in the case because it's got a battery in the case.
Which ones are these? Is there a particular make and model you have?
This make is called Anchorfire, which is not the sort of, you know, £100 plus Apple earbuds and or Samsung equivalent and so on. They're a sort of nice third-party, let's say mid-range brand. They're really solid and really nice. And I would definitely be buying wireless headphones again after this.
Yeah. So as I speak to you both, I'm using wireless earbuds as my, you know,
in-ear monitors, I think they call them in the biz.
Yes, I suppose that's how I'm using them. They are not that. But yeah, I've totally converted to wireless headsets and earbuds in particular. And I love these. The only issue I have with these is the battery life is not excellent. It's like 4 hours. But like you've just described, little case is a battery charger in itself. So you just plop them in the case and they charge quite quickly. But yeah, I love the wireless earbuds.
I have a pair of Redmi Buds, which I bought on Banggood for like $16 or something like that. And I haven't found a use for them. But now you've said that about lying in bed with one ear in. I usually lie in bed with a pair of wired headphones with one ear in, the upward facing ear in, and the other one tucked under the pillow. And I find in the middle of the night, I end up garrotting myself as I roll over.
Yeah, the other one I do is pull the phone off of the bedside table when I turn over. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And it slams on the floor and wakes everyone up. So I'm going to give these a try and see if they work in bed. Good tip.
So, Alan, what have you been up to?
I went for a midlife crisis this week and decided...
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, I thought I'd arrange one in advance. I went to test drive a Tesla Model 3 because why not?
Wow.
Yes. I booked it somewhat slightly drunkenly last weekend. Over the weekend, I thought, I could test drive one of these because friend and ex-presenter of this very show, Dave Walker... popped over to my house recently, and he has one. And I only discovered this when he drove away silently. And I was like, hang on a minute. You've got a very quiet car over there. And he introduced me to the glory that is Teslas. So that following weekend, after a few beers, I went to their website and booked myself a test drive. And I got a phone call a couple of days later from... a salesperson at Tesla. Hello, I understand you booked a test drive. I was like, did I? Oh, yes, I did. Yes, you're right, I did. And so I went yesterday, drove over there, showed them my driving license. They handed me the key. We're like, it's over there. Off you go. It was
brilliant.
Very different experience from any other sales opportunity that I've ever had in a car showroom.
So were you Unaccompanied?
Yep. They just basically handed me the key, went, off you go, got in the car. He said, there's a pre-programmed route in there. You can do that if you want, or you can do something else. And I went off for a scoot down the M4 and round a few roundabouts. And the model I used was the Model 3 Performance, which is all-wheel drive and very fast. And I had a grin from ear to ear the whole time I was driving this thing. It was hilarious. The standing starts away from traffic lights is just ludicrous. I know it's called ludicrous, but it was just ludicrous, a ballistic missile of a car. And then I took it back and I went inside, handed the car to the guy, still with my stupid Cheshire Cat grin on my face, handed the key back to him, and he went, do you want to come and have a look in the showroom at the various options? And I was like, no, it's very dangerous for me to go wandering around a car showroom. He said, okay, no worries. Well, it's all on the website. If you want to buy one, you can just order it online. No worries. And it was very relaxed, very chilled, just going and taking a hilariously overspecced car out for a drive. It was lovely.
I feel like as soon as you left the showroom, he turned to his colleague and said, he'll be back.
Do you know, when he phoned me, he said, I understand you're looking to book a test drive. And I said, yeah. He said, I said, look, I'll be honest with you. I don't want to waste your time. There's no likelihood I'm going to buy one of your cars in the next 6 months. I just fancied having a driver one. He went, yeah, that's fine. He said, we have data. We know that people who come and have a test drive in the future, they're likely to hire one or probably buy one. Mm-hmm. So don't worry about it. And I was like, well, I don't want to take someone else's slot. You know, you might have a possible sale that you're missing out on by letting me drive the car for an hour rather than someone else. He went, no, don't worry about it. It happens all the time. It's fine. And they were just perfectly fine about it. Yeah, the fact that I'm telling you and all our 25 listeners about this means that it clearly works because I'm talking about it.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I imagine they were comfortable in just letting you get in the car and drive off, because if they wanted to, they could have, you know, locked you in the car and had the car return home under some kind of automated mechanism, right?
I mean, they had a photocopy of my driving license. They knew who I was and where I was and, you know. Yeah, I don't think I look too much like Ronnie and Reggie Cray. So, yeah, I wasn't going to take it away and break it down for parts.
Brilliant. Right. Well, with that, let's get on with the rest of the show. So we have some community news. And the first news that we have is that the Manjaro community has a new home. It sounds like they had an unfortunate incident where they were updating their existing community forums and it didn't go as well as they'd hoped. And they've lost all of the uploaded files to the forum.
It sounds like not only the files, the uploaded files, but also the backups were affected as well. So they didn't have any way of fixing this. So they decided to cut their losses and start from scratch with a new forum.
It's easy to have a chuckle at someone else's misfortune. Yeah, they are our friends. We have good friends in the Manjaro community. And, you know, point and laugh and say, lol, backups. You clearly don't know what they are. But honestly, that is a damning indictment of the sysadmin skills. It really is. Because it should not be possible for you to screw up the production system and all the backups in one go. Your backups should be offline somewhere else. Like, I know I'm not trying to tempt fate and say that we're the best DevOps people in the world, but for our Ubuntu podcast website, there's offline backups on a completely different network, completely different disks, going back years.
I feel like it's on your server in your house with the backups for the rest of the Linux community in the UK.
But it feels like if that's an important part of your infrastructure, you should have satisfactory backups. And yeah, okay, it's only the forums and it's only the images and they can restart and it's not a major loss. It's a bit of a shame for those people who go searching around the internet and they click a link and they discover, you know, a busted link to a forum, or they get redirected to an archive that no longer has the images. It's a bit sad.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is a wake-up call to a lot of those distros. Manjaro is one of the top 10 distros, I would say, on the planet, and should have taken this more seriously.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. They have kept the old forum around as an archive, albeit without the images, you know, that they once had. I think before they were using Discourse, and they are using Discourse again. And I've actually been considering paying Discourse to host the Ubuntu Mate Discourse. So it's like one less thing we have to worry about. I'm giving that serious consideration. This pricked, you know, the back of my mind with, you know, there is that thing that's out there in a Docker container and all the rest of it, and it's just another headache. And I quite like not having to have infrastructure to look after these days.
Yeah, you're getting old. Doing all that SSH nonsense.
Getting busy.
Yeah.
So, Alan, what's next?
Next up, Mark Shuttleworth has waded into some threads on the Snapcraft forum, which revolve around the closed source nature of the Snap Store. And I think this was welcome because there's a lot of speculation and conjecture and guesswork going on from people. And a few of us have given reasons why parts of the Snap Store is non-free. And it's not all of it. There's a little bit of it that's non-free, but it's enough to make it non-free, you know? Having a hair in your soup doesn't mean your entire soup is made of hair. It's just like one hair in your soup is enough, right? So one bit of the infrastructure being non-free is enough for some people. I know it's a rubbish analogy, but I'm going with it. Anyway, Mark has waded in on the forums and had discussion with members of the community, basically agreeing that, yeah, it is something that in your position, I would possibly feel the same way, but also explaining his background and rationale and the reasons why he feels is on the right path and reasons why, you know, this direction he feels is the right one. It's a relatively lengthy thread. It's like 40 something comments already. But I think it's worth a read for those people who are interested in, you know, the details behind the curtain, because there's been a lot of sky is falling, Chicken Little style. Oh no, these guys are evil and they're doing this for nefarious purposes, and speculation about why stuff happens. And I think it's interesting that Mark has jumped on the forum to reply to community members. And I don't think there's many communities where the person who bankrolls a thing behind the project is willing to jump on and give their 2 pence in amongst every other community member who's interested. And that's, Mark's done that for years. He's like, he's always kept an eye on these things, and he's not always waded in because I'm sure the guy is busy and has lots of other things to do. But I think it's interesting that he waded in on this subject that's clearly important for the community, and he wanted to give his 2p.
And also his replies are not short either. He's obviously given this some thought. He's quite lengthy replies.
Mm. Yeah, it's really considered stuff.
Yeah, worth a read.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Mark, what have you got?
Well, announced last night, I think it was, Jupiter Broadcasting is now independent again. So Jupiter Broadcasting is the podcasting network responsible for such shows as Linux Unplugged and Linux Action News, and previously provided us with production services, and they were acquired by Linux Academy a few years ago, who were then acquired by another company called A Cloud Guru, but now they are forking themselves off as their own company once again, and will continue on as an independent entity.
Yeah, so Popey and I joined their Linux Unplugged recording last night as we record this to join Chris and support him in his news. And you mentioned Linux Action News there. Well, Linux Action News had actually sort of been put on hiatus a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And as part of this announcement, Linux Action News is coming back. So that means our friend Joe Ressington will be reprising his role as co-host on Linux Action News. And they've also introduced a new funding model for Linux Unplugged for people to be monthly subscribers to get an ad-free version of Linux Unplugged as a part of this, you know, package of, you know, rebooting themselves as an independent media organization. So congratulations to Chris and everyone over at JB.
It's good to see. You know, we're good friends of Chris, I think, or he's good friends of ours. I think.
You hope he feels the same way.
Yeah, I don't wish to suppose. And it's really nice to see that he's extricated himself from that arrangement and now can, I think, probably have a bit more freedom in in what he does. So I think a lot of us have certainly grown up over the last 10 years of podcasting, listening to much of the content that Chris has been responsible for.
Yeah.
And so I think it's good that he can, you know, stretch his legs again and all those other metaphors with more podcasts. Martin, what's all this about Ayatana indicators?
Right. So a good friend of mine, Mike Gabriel, really fell in love with the Ubuntu indicators. He saw those as I'd implemented them in Ubuntu Mate initially, and he wanted to bring that experience to Debian. Mike is a Debian developer. And so he forked the Ubuntu indicators and all of their associated tooling and technologies as Ayatana indicators. Ayatana being the code name, I believe, that all of that UI work would under an umbrella within Canonical as it was developed for Unity. Is that right?
Yeah. The old design team and UX was Ayatana.
Right. So, but what has happened recently is another developer, Robert Tarry, has now fixed these Ayatana indicators so they work on vanilla unpatched GTK3. So in order for the Ubuntu indicators to work, we carry a patch against GTK3 in Ubuntu that enables what's called IDO, the brilliantly named Libido, to function. And it's what renders the widgets inside the indicators. And he's got that working on vanilla GTK. So this unlocked a whole bunch of potential. And it now means that any distro or any desktop environment can integrate proper support for indicators in their environment. So to that end, Mate Desktop 124.1 has support for the Ayatana indicators, as well as a fallback to Ubuntu indicators. And Marius Gripsgaard at UB Ports is integrating the Ayatana indicators into Ubuntu Touch.
Oh, nice.
And I've made the same change in Ubuntu Mate 2010. I did a live stream about that a couple of nights ago, going through, you know, really ripping apart Ubuntu Mate and putting it back together again, because this is quite a sort of invasive change. Robert Tarry, who did this last, like the last mile of this work, he's going to become a paid developer working on Ayatana indicators underneath Mike Gabriel's sort of consulting organization. So he's got himself a job out of this work that he did. Speaking to Mike, he said, you know, we should let all of the other desktop environment developers and participators know that they're encouraged to come and get involved. You know, so if you want to uplift your indicator experience in the desktop that you care about, it's open. Come and join. And we'll have a link to, the Ayatana indicators project on GitHub, for you to come and get involved.
Nice.
And Alan.
Finally, Yaru Colors is a theme project to bring different colors to Ubuntu's awesome Yaru theme. That's their words, not mine, but I agree. This contains themes that contain a GTK2 theme, a GNOME Shell theme, recolored icons and cursors, and the Ubuntu Dock theme, and Unity support as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes, oh, and wallpapers that are all part of this, enabling you to like choose a particular color scheme within Yaru. Mm-hmm. So you could have Like, should you really want it? Yarrow brown, if you really want, or Yarrow orange, or Yarrow purple, or, you know, pick one of these particular themes. So you're not stuck with the stock Yarrow experience that has already been designed by the Yarrow team and the desktop team and the design team. You get the ability to tweak it a little bit further beyond, you know, Yarrow light, Yarrow dark. You've got further options beyond that, which I thought is quite nice to build upon the work the Yarrow team have already done and make it a little bit more flexible. I've not tried it myself, but it looks quite neat. And I thought it was super impressive that someone's built upon the good work of the Yarrow team. The only thing I would say is it's spelt wrong. It's spelt C-O-L-O-R-S. And that's just, I'll file an issue on the Upstream project and suggest they rename it to Yarrow Colors with a U.
Okay.
They've got two shades of green. They've got green and they have Mate green.
Yes. I was surprised that didn't say cucumber or whatever it is you call it.
Chelsea cucumber.
Chelsea cucumber. Yeah. I think it's great. This is just, I love this. I love that people build upon the open source work of others in our community. I love it.
Yeah. I've been meaning to get involved in Yarrow to create a derivative or, you know, a version of it for Ubuntu Mate. And the fact that somebody in the community has made something with like a dozen color variations that includes Mate green, then I should be looking at this because I know there's a few changes that need to be made or additions that need to be made to Yarrow to support Mate. So I'll be looking at doing that in the Upstream Yarrow project and then signposting those changes to this, this individual, because there's still time for me to maybe squeeze that into Ubuntu Mate 2010 if there's a, you know.
And that's a live stream right there, really, isn't it? That's like that's gold content right there, or any other kind of color content, in fact.
Yes. Well, there we go. So with that, let's move on to the news headlines. So we've got some of our picks from the wider tech news. The first story that I saw is that WSL2 is being backported to older versions of Windows 10.
So hold on. Windows 10 is like the current version of Windows, yeah?
Yeah. It's a rolling release, isn't it? It kind of is, but it isn't.
Right. So how can there be older versions of Windows 10 to backport to? Isn't everyone just on Windows 10?
No. Because there are like roll up, you can think of it almost like service packs. There's like the version of Windows that most people have in consumer land right now is Windows 10 version 2004.
Right.
Which came out in April this year.
Oh, not in 2004.
No, think of it as 2004.
Oh, 2004. Okay, right. Yes, I'm with you.
And there are previous builds. That, okay. Some people stick on, because you know, in the enterprise environment, some people say sticky on a particular build and they don't want to roll out all this new stuff, because actually what happens with Windows 10 is new features land with these new builds of Windows 10. There is just one. It's like Arch Linux, and you're getting new stuff arriving all the time. And some people don't want Arch Linux. They want a stable LTS. And so there are corporate environments where they have Windows 10 running 1903 or 1909, the previous builds that, you know, they want to stick to on their estate. But what Microsoft has done is they backported WSL2, which is the version that uses virtual machines and has proper Linux kernel support. They've backported it to those for x86 systems so that those enterprise users who are sticky on those older releases of Windows 10 can get the benefits of WSL2 and run Ubuntu or other distros within WSL2 without having to upgrade their entire estate to the latest version of Windows 10. That's the goal.
Right. I think I understand that now. I think what that means is I'll be able to run WSL2 at work.
Yes.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's kind of why we put it in here.
Especially for me. Oh, I'm on it.
Yeah, like we lobbied hard with the guys at Microsoft and said, look, our friend Mark like really needs this.
So you're welcome, Mark.
Yeah, thanks.
Alan, what did you find?
Oh, gosh. Apple and Epic are going at it. And it's, you know, bring your popcorn. It's the fight of the century. You know, trillion-dollar company versus Chinese-backed you know, $1 million, potentially $1 billion company. So an American judge has ruled that Apple are able to block the Epic Games Fortnite game from their app store because it transgressed the rules that that Epic had signed up for when they put Fortnite in the Apple app store. But what they can't do, Apple can't do, is intentionally block Unreal Engine, which is also made by Epic, but is used by third-party developers. And the judge is saying, basically, you two can have a punch-up, but the collateral damage of you causing a problem for third-party developers who use Unreal Engine in order to publish games in the Apple App Store, that's unreasonable. So Apple's overreaching by blocking Unreal.
So what rules did Epic break exactly?
So when you publish a commercial application in the App Store, there are rules. And one of those rules is if you have you take payments within your application, then you need to give Apple a cut of that. And typically that's 30%. And Epic published a build of Fortnite that basically bypassed this. And Apple said, "You naughty, naughty man, Tim Sweeney, you should not be doing that. You should change that." And Epic went a bit public with a lawsuit and a whole promotional campaign, which was a bit tasteless, trying to get everyone on side with a whole faux 1984 Apple is the evil that they sought to, you know, supplant kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, it's got a bit tasteless, and there's real factions on both sides. You know, some people who think, you know, Apple are in the right for blocking updates to Fortnite in the store. So mm-hmm. people who've already got it still get to keep Fortnite, but no new users can install it. Whereas others feel that Apple is overreaching, and actually their rules are making it difficult for other people to enter the market. And so, yeah, it's one of those bun fights that will run for a while in legal circles.
Yeah.
We shall wait and see.
Yeah, it should be said, although there was this court ruling is a sort of interim ruling until there's an actual full case to...
Which is a bit later on in September, I think, is when it starts, but who knows how long that'll take.
Yes. And I saw someone say, like, posted a announcement from Microsoft in favor of Epic's position, and this announcement turned out to be a 500-page court document.
Yeah. Epic have friends in high places.
So, Mark, speaking of Microsoft,
Windows 95 is 25.
Really?
I feel old.
So I spotted this on the BBC News website, because they shared an archive news story from when it was launched, and, you know, showing people queuing up for the midnight opening. And one of the parts of their story was an interview with Douglas Adams, author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And his interview was basically a rant about how much he didn't like Microsoft and didn't trust them.
He was a well-known Apple fanboy.
Really?
I think at the time when some of the early, some new Mac came out, I don't know if it was the Macintosh, I think the first one in the UK was him or Stephen Fry, or it was, there was, the pair of them had, like, you know, the first couple of Macs in the country. So they're, you know, dyed-in-the-wall Mac fans.
Yes.
So it's not surprising Douglas Adams would be a little bit bitchy about Microsoft.
Yeah. But yeah, it was interesting seeing sort of some of the angles to the news report about how it would affect the internet moving forwards, about how the internet at that point had no particular focus on any particular system, but this was going to pull everyone into Microsoft's ecosystem.
Well, I do remember this.
Mm. And do you?
Yes,
I do. For some reason, I don't. I can't imagine why.
All right. Pull up a chair. Let me tell you a story. When 95 came out, I had a Toshiba 2100 CS laptop, and I had Windows 3.11 for workgroups. And getting online on Windows 3.11 and below was a bit of a fraught thing. It didn't have really particularly good networking built in. You had to add additional dialer software, and you had to add an IP stack really to get you online properly. And Windows 95 brought all of that built in. Mm-hmm. And so it had the whole, TCP/IP and the ability to do Windows login and all that kind of stuff out of the box. And I remember the day it released, I think it was a Friday, and I worked for a company called Lantech in Slough, in Langley, near Slough, gateway to the south. And I had my Toshiba with me in the office that day. And because I'd had this laptop for a while, it was, the disk was really full. It was a 210 meg hard drive or something like that. Blimey. It was super full. And I'd used something called Drive Space to compress the disk. And the day that Windows 95 came out, the guy who sat next to me, a guy called Klaus Blasing, handed me the CD or whatever it was that had Windows 95 on it. And I put it on there and it started the install on Friday. And it took the entire weekend. I had to leave my laptop at work for the entire weekend because it had to keep uncompressing and recompressing files on this compressed disk in order to do the upgrade. But it worked from 3.11 to 95. And it was quite a marked change from the OS that I had on there previously. It was quite a jump. And I really enjoyed Windows 95.
I remember the Windows 95 release as being the most celebrated sort of software release I've ever seen, ever. It was a big deal. I remember there was a story because they had the start button, of course, in Windows 95. Yeah. And they used the Start Me Up song from the Rolling Stones. And I think the story goes is that the Rolling Stones were approached to use that music and they said no. And then they were asked to name their price. So they named the most ridiculous price ever. And Bill Gates went, done, fine.
8 million, apparently, is what it costs for using that song. So, yeah, Windows 95. And actually, I still have machines running Windows 95 now. Old ThinkPads, funnily enough.
No way.
Yeah, I know, right? And, yeah, it's still quite nostalgic to go back and have a tinker with Windows 95. However much abuse Microsoft and Windows gets over the years, and I've dished it out, 95 was actually quite a jump from what came before.
Yeah. I was a OS 2 user. I didn't do the whole Windows 95 thing. OS 2 warp for the win. So, Mark, you've got a final news item.
Yes. It turns out that the Scots Wikipedia isn't in Scots.
Uh-oh.
Yes. So if you go to seo.wikipedia.org, you'll find a lovely, you know, this is Wikipedia is in multiple languages, not just English, and you can go to various subdomains and get it in various languages. This is supposed to be Wikipedia in the Lowland Scots dialect. But basically, it turns out that there's 60,000 articles there, which were just written by some guy who doesn't speak Scots and just went through and wrote things in sort of English with some butchered words to make it sound a bit Scottish.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. Larger than a hamlet, but smaller than a toon, we a population ranging frae a few hundred tae a few thousand is an example of some of the translation. Yeah, this one guy just sort of decided to set it up and administer it and write all of these articles, and some Scottish people spotted this and started alerting people to the fact that this isn't what Scottish is like as a language.
Isn't this sort of indicative of some of the sort of criticism that's been levelled at Wikipedia, that in the past they've had, you know, people editing articles that are not who or what they claim they are and don't have the authority to, you know, put authoritative information up into the site?
I think it's one of the side effects of being crowdsourced, fully crowdsourced. You know, there's the same thing happens on, or has happened on OpenStreetMap, where people make edits and they're just wildly wrong. And, you know, the road doesn't go there at all, but you expect other people to review it. But I think the difficulty here is in a, forgive me, Scotland, niche language, it's difficult to find people who are that enthusiastic and know it well enough to spot this.
Well, there you go. If you fancy a giggle, seo.wikipedia.org until enough Scottish people are rounded up to fix it.
To revert all the edits, yeah.
Oh, and that concludes our news. And that's all for episode 23. Thank you all for listening. Next week, we're going to be discussing the PinePhone and the PineBook Pro, where we're going over all of your feedback, and I believe we're going to squeeze in some command line love as well. So, in the meantime, You can contact us at show@ubuntupodcast.org. And if you are looking for some podcast production services, then head over to joerest.com. Speak to you next time.